The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Yeah. All right, coming off a big July 4th weekend, including a pretty interesting Wimbledon tournament. I wanted to have this guy on, but unfortunately he was en route from England all day, so we couldn't tape this until Monday afternoon, but now he's here in the Subway Fresh Take Hotline from Sports Illustrated. John Wertheim, what's happening?
Hey, how are you?
How was the flight back?
Oh, I tell you, good flight. I had Roddick and Serena on my flight, so that's one trophy and one runners-up trophy.
Were they in first class?
I was going to say, you probably, it goes without saying, we did not share the same class cabin. And you can yes. guess at baggage claim, who had more luggage, Serena or Roddick?
Yeah, how much baggage would Serena Williams bring to England for 2.5 weeks?
You'd be surprised. I thought she's moving there. I mean, people have moved overseas with fewer suitcases.
I always thought that should be a show of just athletes coming and going from places, and just I think people would be fascinated to see the amount of stuff athletes have. I saw the Cleveland Cavaliers, their bus coming from an airport, the bus pulling in front of the hotel, and all the things that came off the bus. It had first of all, it was his own bus. There was nobody else on it. It was a bus that trailed the other bus. And it was more stuff than I've ever seen in my life. For basically, they were there for 2 days.
They were they had a crazy opening set, though. It's like the Rolling Stones. If these guys were paying, they were paying $25 a bag, it might be a little different.
Where does somebody like Andy Roddick or Serena Williams stay when they're in England?
Well, actually, I'll tell you a funny story. At Wimbledon, it's great because instead of staying at a hotel, everybody basically rents a house in the village, in Wimbledon Village. And, you go to Starbucks and it's like, here comes Rod Laver. Oh, no, here comes Andy Roddick. It's sort of like a fantasy weekend in Wimbledon Village. But, Federer gets this crazy, the granite countertops. He gets this sort of crazy $10,000 a week spread. And I actually checked out where Nadal stays, and it's this little townhouse, and he actually is staying, they're renting it from a family, and he's staying in the boys' room. So here's Nadal, Wimbledon champion, and he's staying in a room, and, the room where he stays, on the door, there's a birthday card to little Billy, I hope your 12th is a good one. little different sensibilities there between Federer and Nadal.
Well, what happens to all the people in the Wimbledon Village? Where do they go?
Oh, they all go to Mallorca. They all get 10 grand a week to rent their place and get the hell out of town.
Yeah, but if you lived in Wimbledon, wouldn't the best part of living in Wimbledon be Wimbledon?
I think, they can't pass up. It's a recession. No, it's really interesting because literally, I mean, I stayed at this complex and it was, Brad Gilbert and Chris Fowler were staying there. It's literally, you're absolutely right. It's sort of like where are all the townsfolk? And if you say you live in Wimbledon, it's kind of weak to go away for the 2 weeks when your little town actually has some sort of currency. But it just gets overtaken with the sort of the tennis caravan.
Yeah, I can't even think of another comparison.
Masters, does Augusta all go to, does Augusta all go to Hilton Head during the Masters? I don't know.
But the difference with that would be Augusta's only like 5-6 days max, and unless you have a lot of access, you probably can't go anyway or in the gallery or whatever. But if you're in Wimbledon, I can't imagine anything else happens during the year at Wimbledon.
It's a nice quiet suburb. The other thing I think I get a kick out of is, it's not like Augusta. You've got this huge tennis complex with, a 15,000 seat stadium court with a retractable roof. And then, they use this club, not year round, but it's a regular tennis club. So it's pretty funny that, Lord Gloucester or whatever is playing tennis today and playing his buddies in, men's 65 doubles, and they're playing on center court right now.
So is Wimbledon like, is it like Greenwich? Is it like Pebble Beach? Is it ritzy? I don't know anything about it.
But in a much more tasteful way, and it's really tiny. I mean, it's sort of one little main drag. It's very sort of quaint, and it's a great event. You go to the Kentucky Derby, and you're like, okay, I've been there once, check it off the list. But it's a great sporting event, and it's sort of this quiet little town that gets overtaken. But No, it's put it on the list if you've never been.
Look, it's been on the list, and my big mistake was not doing it before I have kids, and now I have to wait until the youngest one, I think, turns 3, and then I wouldn't feel bad about bringing my wife there and ditching the kids for like a week. But I've been dying to go. I can't wait to go.
You're singing my song there. I mean, the other thing too is that you know, I tried to get someone tickets the other day for a session. They said, "Oh, you had to jump through a million hoops to get them," but there's really no scalping. So a ticket, you know, a grounds pass for Wimbledon is like $12. So,
so how do you get them?
Well, it's a sort of quaint clubby event, and you've got to sort of know someone who knows. Yeah, I'll hook you up. If you want to go, we'll figure it out. But it's funny, you know, there's no signage, and there's no stadium rights, and they, you know, I love that they leave that. I mean, you know about sort of how the sports TV work. They leave that middle Sunday open. You imagine a sports property that says, yeah, Sunday session, we'd rather not have it.
Right.
So I'll take a break.
Well,
so
but they have to do that for rain, though, right?
No, it's just
or they just leave it open.
Yeah, just tradition. You know, they got the roof now, so. But no, it's just kind of a tradition thing, and they don't want to disrupt. You know, they don't want to disrupt the neighbors on the Lord's Day. So there's no middle Sunday tennis where they. I mean, that's tens of millions of dollars are leaving on the table, and the same thing with these tickets. That it's hard to get, but once you get them, you know, it's $20 and you got a seat.
I also like the whole gambling aspect to Wimbledon. I love the fact that England, it's like such a big part of it, and they even like what's the site, Betfair?
No. Yeah, Betfair. Yeah, Betfair.
Betfair. They raised a big stink because one of the matches had irregular gambling patterns. I wish America worked like this.
Online, that's what we need, more online gambling.
We need more online gambling, and we need it to be a bigger part of each sport. So how would you rate this year's Wimbledon, like a 7.5? 7.5 out of 10? 8?
Oh, come on. We got to... Yeah, I give it. The women dragged it down a little, to be honest. But
it's got to factor it in. It's 50-50.
The boy, if Andy Murray had made the final,
yeah.
I mean, it's just I can't. No U.S. athlete goes through this. The kind of pressure where you have the whole hopes of a country pinned on you. I mean, when he was playing his matches, you know, third, fourth round match, were doing Super Bowl type ratings. And I mean, I was joking that his coverage was so big and. In over in England, you know, there was some story about a pop star that died in L.A. or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just crazy. If he had gotten to the, you know, Roddick beat him in the semifinals, but if that guy had gotten to the finals, it would have just been absolute pandemonium. But, you know, as it was, you got Federer winning, you got a great five-set men's final, nice weather, good tournament overall.
The Andy Murray thing, and whenever a British guy or anybody from that neck of the woods is involved, it's like the Cubs making the playoffs, but if all of Great Britain and the surrounding areas were the Cubs fans.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's it means almost too much. And I actually thought when he was in the semis against Roddick, and I know he was favored and everybody just kind of assumed he was going to roll through that one, I think. And I just thought it was too much pressure. And unfortunately, I didn't get to see the match live because they don't show Wimbledon here live.
I heard that.
But and by the time I found out what happened, I couldn't actually watch the match and just kind of watch it as I'm watching it live. I knew it was going to happen. But I just thought he looked – you could see the weight of the world on his shoulders. He played well, but a lot of pressure for that
stage. This guy was getting – before the tournament started, he was getting, you know, the texts from Sean Connery and the – who knew the Queen? Who knew the Queen knows how to SMS? You know, Beckham, sort of every Brit short of, you know, Paul McCartney's coming out and, rooting for this guy. And, you know, he'd go to these press conferences. Most players go to the press conference. How do you think you served today? Or the court's playing fast. He goes to the press conference. They're asking him about the tax policy. And it's just, I mean, I can't imagine playing with that. And, you know, tennis isn't one of these sports where you love the home court advantage and you know, you love the fireworks when you come out of the tunnel for the lineups. I mean, these players kind of talk about how you like to just kind of stay under the radar and not have a lot of distractions. So it's not one of these sports where you necessarily benefit from having 15,000 people cheering you every time you play.
Yeah, it's a sport where they don't even like you to make noise as they're trying to serve, much less to pick apart what might mean to the history of whatever.
No T-shirts being air cannoned either.
Yeah.
The sport's missing.
Oh, I ended up watching the match, even though I knew it was going to happen. And I don't think a lot of people here watched the match, which was a shame because you just saw the way it ended. And you're like, it must not have been that good. It was actually really good and really tense and well played. And I thought it was, in a way, I thought it was better than the final, because here's the thing, and here's my case for why the final wasn't nearly as good as last year. I know it was, you know, whatever, double figures last set. At no point after the second set did I think Adi Rada could win. None.
Is that right?
I was just watching. I was like, it doesn't matter. He's not Federer. Once Federer came back from the four down and the tiebreaker, that was it. I just didn't think he could beat the guy. And last year, I had no idea who was going to win. And that's what made it great to me. And this year, I just thought, you know, however long it's going to take, Federer is going to end up winning this.
I mean, I think a lot of people had that suspicion. Also, it's a little different just sort of from a rhythm standpoint, watching two guys have these rallies and actually sort of have this sort of jousting.
Yeah.
Versus just walking up to the line, banging some 135-mile-an-hour serve, and then doing it again in the other box. I mean, great, great match, but I'm with you. I think last year's was better.
And there was some really good shot making. It's not, you know, it's not like it was just the kind of tennis that I think got the sport in trouble a little bit. It just guys blasting serves. There were a couple nice moments, but on the whole, I just prefer last year's match a lot more. And I just think, I don't think people will remember this Raddick match a couple of years from now, but I think they're always going to remember the match last year.
I think the other thing is just last year was, you know, one versus two and two guys in this rivalry, and if Nadal wins, he becomes number one and he takes down Federer on grass. I mean, just sort of had all those classical plot lines.
Yeah.
This one a little less so. But also, it was weird because, you know, Federer actually served like twice as many aces as Roddick.
Yeah.
And Roddick kind of won the majority of the point. You know, Roddick played great from the back. It was sort of like this weird role reversal. But, yeah, you feel for Andy. I mean, he's you know, good kid, good people, and he's still kind of waiting for that second major, and to get a couple points for winning Wimbledon is that's a tough one to walk away from with a loss.
You feel for him until you remember he's rich and he's married to a swimsuit model.
Yeah, right.
Then you don't feel for him like quite as much. But
it's not working the coal mines. No.
Well, let me ask you. So he turns 27 next month. He's won one career major. The defining moment of his career so far, in my opinion, was probably yesterday's match. Is his career a success or a failure compared to what we thought 10 years ago?
Oh, I mean, I think the great sort of the great wrench in all this guy from Switzerland came along who was just a better player. And I don't think Andy would disagree with that. But I think, you know, not the most, I think Andy's almost an overachiever. You know, good athlete, works hard, but not the most sort of versatile or graceful game. And I think he got a lot out of his talents. He's still, you know, 8 years now he's been in the top 10. He's never built on that one Grand Slam he won. He's come close, but I think he's, you know, I think he's done pretty well for himself. And I also, you know, are the Warriors going to give you an NBA? Are the Warriors going to make the playoffs next year? Absolutely not, right?
Right.
I mean, the tennis is these Grand Slams. It's only seven matches. Like, you know, you can come in pretty cold and play yourself into the quarterfinals, and then it's who knows. So I think, you know, people say Roddick's never going to win again, and you want to say, you know, it doesn't take all that much to get back on the board. I mean, it's 2 weeks of great tennis, basically. So, you know, who knows? I think he may end up retiring with another major or two.
At the same time, he was supposed to be the successor to Sampras and Agassi, right?
Yeah, I mean, which was a little sort of, I think.
Or is that just unfair to him in retrospect?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think he got a little screwed by history because there was all this expectation on the heels of this great generation. Then he got screwed by history on the back end because here comes Roger Federer to sort of, you know, if Roger Federer isn't in the picture and Roddick's playing, you know, the Leighton Hewitts and the Andy Murrays and the Saffins instead of Federer and then Nadal, I think he's doing a lot better. Bad timing on his part.
Yeah, that would be an interesting. I wonder what other tennis players had bad timing in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, you get the feeling if the guy. I mean, you hate to even. It's a little silly, but if you know if Roddick was born 5 years earlier or 5 years later, he's a much different career.
I always thought Roscoe Tanner was one of those guys.
There you go. Roscoe Tanner's got bigger issues than his.
Well, I know he does now, but
historical relevance. So,
Roscoe Tanner had that great serve, but he came in the middle of this just boon for tennis and was never. He's kind of like the Ernie Shavers of. Of tennis, that thing. I feel like Roddick's career has been disappointing. I know I can't really present a lot of evidence, but I think it had more to do with the fact that as he was rising up, he kind of caught that wave of, and we do it, ESPN the magazine with that next issue. You got to like figure out who's next. Who's coming up? Who's next?
Right,
and
right.
Roddick got kind of thrown into that. And then eventually people like me, the more casual fans, thought, well, wait, Andy Roddick, shouldn't he have like 10 majors by now? And, you know, maybe he just wasn't that guy.
The, I'll tell you one thing that's funny about him is, you know, he had Brad Gilbert there when he won his first major, and then he ends up getting Jimmy Connors, and it's, you know, one of these Anakin Skywalker, you know, the old master coming to work with the protege, and that didn't necessarily go anywhere. Now he's got, this coach, Larry Stefanke, who's, you know, perfectly respectable coach, but wasn't a great, you know, Grand Slam champion. You know, it's sort of like you get rid of Phil Jackson and you go hire Frank Hamlin or someone. And Roddick's had much more success, and is really, his game has evolved a lot more under Larry Stefanke than under, you know, the great Jimmy Connors or even Brad Gilbert.
Hmm. So Larry Stefanke, like the Phil Jackson of tennis, maybe?
Yeah, exactly.
Does he give out books to Andy Roddick? Here's this book I want you to read. It's The Color Purple. I don't know why, but I just feel like it's going to make you better mentally and stronger. Williams sisters, can we even count the number of great Wimbledon matches they've had on two fingers?
With each other or period?
With each other.
No.
It's just it's always depressing. Yeah, they're never... They're just never going to let all out against each other. And why would they?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's not only that they're siblings, but they're like siblings with a capital S. I mean, they're like sharing a villa. They're staying together. I was just writing that, you know, the Klitschko brothers wouldn't think of fighting each other.
Yeah. They said that. They wouldn't. They refused to fight each other.
Yeah, exactly. And this is, you know, there's no one's getting beat up here, but a little bit of the same thing where you just can't get the tension going. I mean, you just can't drum up that competitive, you know, those competitive juices just don't come when you're playing against blood. And I still think it's a great story. I still think, you know, we've known about them for 10 years now. Everybody's heard the story. It's sort of, you know, old news, but stand back and just think, I mean, I just think this is like the most incredible story in sports that everybody's just kind of rolls their eyes at now.
But, well, they roll their eyes at it because every time they play, it stinks when they play each other. And I think that's the issue, is that it is this awesome story, but it leads to this conclusion of a really lousy final match every time they go head-to-head. It just stinks. And you saw in the semifinals with Serena, you know, if there had been 10 more moments like that over the last 10 years, I think people would talk about them, right?
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know if she's, you know, you're not pumping fists and staring down the girl that, like, braiding your hair in the morning.
I mean, arguably, it's probably, I don't know, is it a good thing or a bad thing that the Williams sisters passed for women's tennis?
Oh, I think it's a good thing. I mean, again, it's just such an amazing story. You had the Richard, you got bonus points for Richard back when, you know, he was at his best. And I just wish, you know, I don't blame them. I wish somebody would stand up to them. I mean, they need a Rafael Nadal to come along and stare them down and say, you know what, I'm not intimidated by you. Instead, you get the feeling that there are a lot of players are out there, and the first thing they do when they see the draw come out is they see how far they are from the Williams sisters because they know they're not going to win that match.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I don't mean that it's a bad thing that they existed. I mean that for the sport of women's tennis, when you look back now, and it's been a full decade, did this put women's tennis in a better place or a worse place with the casual fans that they probably need to get? And I don't know the answer to that. I mean, maybe it certainly made it open the doors of tennis to the African-American community, no question. From a mainstream standpoint, though, I just think you look at what we grew up with and Everett Navratilova, and I don't know. It's just not the same.
You need rivals. No,
yeah,
I mean,
you do.
I wish... You know, I don't know if you saw the match that Serena plays this Dementieva.
I saw it.
And it's sort of like how you felt about Roger and Andy. It was the same thing. I mean, I just said, yeah, I don't care if Serena's down match point. If it's 6-0, 5-0, Serena's going to find a way to win this match. It would be great if one of these other players could just stare them down and say, you know what, it's my time. You know, there's no way I'm losing today. And instead, the Williams sisters, you know, always seem to find a way.
If you had to say one of them was better, which one would you pick?
I think I'd go Serena.
Really?
Yeah. You know, Venus has only won two of the four majors. She's just, you know, won Wimbledon.
She's just won more Wimbledon.
So. Yeah, exactly. And, no, I think Serena sort of technically is better. And I also think, I think they're both great fighters. I think Serena has less of a hard time with the whole sibling thing.
Yeah.
And I think given how often they play for high stakes, that actually matters. And that actually makes a difference. She seems to handle it better than Venus does.
I think the younger sister is always going to have, or younger brother is always going to have an advantage. Because when you're growing up, when you're little, you're constantly exceeding whatever your limits are because you're trying to catch up to the older one. It's like this little carrot dangling in front of you.
Yeah, exactly.
Little Venus will never have a motivation like that. Serena's, the younger one's always going to want to be better. So it's kind of natural order. But, I mean, how many years left do you think they have?
Oh, truthfully, as many. I mean, you know, they only play this kind of like partial schedule.
Yeah.
And they're like the guys who are now, they're now DHing. They get those career years on the backside.
Has this ever happened before where people are basically part-timing professional tennis and winning majors?
You know, I tell you that no. A lot of people can't. I mean, it's really funny to see how they go about their careers. I mean, some of these other players who are, you know, so obsessed with diet and string tension and all, I mean, they just kind of show up, tie up their shoes, and they play well. But I tell you, the opposite's happened, where these players play a full schedule, and they do all the, jump through all the hoops, and they're traveling all over the world, and then, you know, whether it's Justine Henin or Martina Hingis or whoever, they burn out, and by the time they're 24, 25, they say, you know, enough of this. So I think, you know, sure, if you're a promoter, you'd love it if the Williams sisters played 25 events a year, but I think they're doing it a lot smarter than other players.
Well, the history of tennis usually shows that you shouldn't multitask, and that, you know, the people that succeed the most are the people who throw themselves in it and they live and breathe tennis. And once they get that little outside force, and usually for men's tennis, it's some girlfriend. I would call it like the Tatum O'Neal complex. Yeah. John McEnroe met Tatum O'Neal and that was it. All of a sudden you didn't care about winning majors anymore. And you see this happen over and over again where they, you know, they succeed, they peak. Then it becomes a case of, well, how long do I want to have to work my ass off to stay at this level? And then there will be some sort of weird outside factor, and that's it. I'm amazed it hasn't sidetracked the Williams sisters yet.
What about Federer?
How many years is he going now?
You know, this is basically, you know, he won his first Wimbledon in 2003. So this is basically 6 years of pretty uninterrupted reign here, even with, his wife's pregnant now, but boy.
How long did Sam...
Sorry, where's...
Well, how long did Sampras go?
Sampras was his prime? Yeah, six years at number one. But Sampras is one of these guys who was just so devoted. I mean, he was almost freakish like that. But you're right. No, I mean, Agassi's had his... Well, you're right. But usually there's some distraction in the plot and, you know, whether they ever come back or, like, Borg. And even to some extent, McEnroe never get back. It's always kind of interesting to watch.
With Federer, I think the next couple years will determine... Because I think he's already probably... I don't think you'd call him the greatest tennis player, but you can make a case for it. But he's in a discussion now. You have to mention him with the three or four other guys. But now for him, I think it's... Now, where is he going to rank with everybody? Not just tennis. We're talking all the guys. Like, does he... How much does he have to do now to enter the discussion with Jack Nicklaus, with Michael Jordan, guys like that? And I think he needs, like, another year or two, to be honest.
Yeah, no, that's a good... I think... Not saying he's going to do it, but he's not one of these guys who, you know, now that he's married and he got this 15th major, it's off to go fly fishing. I mean, I think he's still going to be in there. But I don't disagree with that at all, that he's really he's still playing for history. It's just no longer Lave or Sampras. It's even that next sort of level of the pantheon. I mean, that streak he has, though, of most underrated streak in sports. This is my stat of the week.
Okay.
He's got 21 straight Grand Slam semifinals, so it's like a top four finish in golf.
Wow!
Guess how many times Tiger's consecutive top four finishes at majors?
How many?
Four is his streak. So the fact that Federer's done it, so I mean, you know, all surfaces for 5 years now, you know, one bad day at the office and you go home.
Well, but beyond that, the physical stress of just playing tennis, like it's kind of amazing that his body would hold up that consistently for 5+ years.
The other thing, too, is the physical stress of travel. I mean, these guys in the NBA go from, you know, they do one of these road trips and they blow off the last two games and they're all getting sick. And, they're not exactly flying from Tashkent to Sydney. I mean, these guys are doing it all over the world. You know, you play 18 countries in a year sometimes.
Yeah.
Part of it's just sort of the physical, part of it's the physical stress, but also a lot of it, I think, is just the, it's such a global sport. It's got to take some wear and tear on your body just to spend so much time in strange countries.
Well, and then mentally, there's no off season. So
yeah, exactly.
You're never saying like, all right, well, I have 3 months off coming up. You kind of have to pick and choose when you take the time off. And a lot of people have trouble just going away for a couple months. You just wrote a book, coincidentally, about Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal, The Strokes of Genius, which is basically centered around last year's Wimbledon match. But what I thought was really interesting about this, and why I guess everybody was so disappointed that they didn't have the rematch this year, was because it really did seem like Nadal had Federer's number. And now this window has been open because Nadal got hurt, and Federer now has reclaimed the throne but didn't really do it by beating Nadal. So now it's like, well, so we got to wait till next year now? How does this play out?
Yeah, no, it's one of these things where it's like, who's writing this? Can we curse on... Cut that.
We'll bleep it.
I'll bleep it. No, it's one of these things where, like, who writes the plots here? That yeah. Nadal takes down Federer in this amazing match. He seems to be in his head. They play the Australian Open, and Nadal again wins in 5 sets, and Federer's left, you know, not just crying, but sob. I mean, just hysterically sobbing right there on the trophy. I mean, it was one of the more remarkable sports scenes I've ever seen.
Yeah.
13-time Grand Slam champion just literally broken to his core, sobbing on a trophy stand. And his rival patting him on the back, saying, you know, it's okay, get it together, buddy. And it looks like Federer's in trouble, and all of a sudden, Nadal tweaks his knees, and Federer beats him, and suddenly, exactly what you said, Federer's now going to be number one again, which nobody saw 2 months ago. So,
in the tennis community,
good plus.
Well, the tennis community was confused because Nadal had changed his game and kept tweaking it and making all these refinements to finally get together, whatever it would take to beat Federer. And Federer just, same guy he was, just plowing along. And, hey, if he beats me, he beats me. I'm dancing with what brung me. And there was like a frustration almost in the tennis community. It seemed like why won't he do this or that or this or that? And do you feel like he's changed at all?
No, I think that's a great point. I remember Tiger took a few months off, and he retooled his swing, and everybody's got a suggestion, and hire a coach, and, you know, play more down the line shots. And Federer basically just said, I know I'm more talented. And it sounded really kind of delusional or at a minimum stubborn at the time. But it's basically, you know, he basically didn't change much of anything. And he's back where, I mean, his attitude was essentially, if I'm at my best, I'm beating this guy. And I don't need to spend, you know, 3 months in isolation working on new weapons. I don't need to do a whole lot of tinkering here. I just need to play my best. And you sort of roll your eyes at that, but that's pretty much how it's played out.
What was the consensus tip that people thought that he needed to do to maybe push over the top again with Nadal?
Well, some of it was just kind of tactical and, you know, use the slice more and just kind of nerdy tennis stuff. But I think a lot of it was just mental, that he needed a coach to get in his head and just kind of get him over this mental block he seemed to have against Nadal. And, you know, he interviewed people and seemed to have gotten close, but he never really did hire that coach. And yet, you know, he beats Nadal in May, wins the French Open, wins Wimbledon, and suddenly sort of doing it his way back on top.
Do you think Nadal comes back 100%?
I hope so, but I keep making the Earl Campbell comparison.
Mm. That's not a good one.
Yeah, exactly. Boy, I hope so. I mean, he's such a great guy, so good for the sport. You know, Federer wins that 15th Grand Slam, and I don't know if you saw, if they showed it, when he came out in this jacket embroidered with a gold 15, and he has this, like, gold man purse, and I'm thinking, for a sport that really needs to kind of toughen up his image, I'm not sure this is helping, boys.
I had a friend who said it looked like all he needed was a sword.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the, you also, you know, They used to sell him as the boy next door and the most down-to-earth guy, and now right after he puts on his gold jacket, he, like, the NetJets commercial comes on.
Right.
Not the image you necessarily are going for if you're trying to tell people this isn't a country club sport. Nadal right. comes out there with the muscle tees and the, you know, Nadal is like, give me a pair of shorts and a t-shirt and let's go.
Right.
And I think, you know, in a lot of ways he's probably healthier for the sport's image, and I just, you know, he plays such a brutal style. I mean, the Earl Campbell is the one I can't get out of my mind. I mean, this guy's not dancing around light on his feet. He's just charging.
I would also, I would say Dwayne Wade as well. Like yeah, that style that you just feel like one time he's going to come down and his shoulder's going to separate again and that'll be it.
Right.
And he can only do it so many times.
And he's not the type that, you know, just like you say to Dwayne Wade, you know what? You know, hey, Dwayne, settle for the jumper.
Yeah.
You know, Nadal's not going to turn into one of these sort of soft counterpunchers or something. I mean, it is who he is. And, you know, God bless the guy, but you do worry that it does not bode well for a long career.
So what under 25 guys do we have?
Oh, we got Andy Murray. We got Djokovic.
He's 20. Andy Murray's 23?
22.
Okay. Who else?
Djokovic, also 22. This guy, Del Potro.
I'm not on the edge of my seat.
Yeah, I know. No, I mean, it's at some point, it's, you know, this is the downside. Seriously, this is the downside to a guy like Federer. You know, in golf, similarly with Tiger, is that when you've got Federer and Nadal, get this, have won 19 of the last 21 majors.
Wow.
Doesn't leave a whole lot for it. You know, it's sort of hard to make a name for yourself. I mean, it doesn't sort of, it's a great rivalry. It's a great achievement for those two guys, but it doesn't leave, it's only table scraps for everybody else. So it's hard to kind of, you know, make a real big dent when there are two guys dominating like that. So, you know, it'll take some time to replace those two guys, but you just hope this rivalry keeps going because it's great. It's great for the sport. It's a great kind of clash of styles, clash of personalities, but it's Nadal's knees that worry me more than anything.
I'm so disappointed that America hasn't done better on this front. I mean, we should be pumping out a new guy every 3 years who's like top 10 caliber.
You want my theory on this?
Sure. I'd love it.
The problem here isn't that these guys are non-American. That, you know, I would say, like, if Houston can get behind Yao Ming, like, it can't just be that these guys are non-American.
Oh, no, I'm just saying I like rooting for Americans. I'm xenophobic saying, with my tennis.
That's all right. I think a lot of the problem is just, but it's more like why the game seems to be slipping a little here. It's not that there aren't so many Americans. It's more that there are no tournaments. So there are no, you know, Federer and Nadal have only played two tournaments. Here it is, you know, first week of July, and they've only played two tournaments in the U.S. all year. So it's kind of hard for tennis to get on the radar. It's hard for young kids to get psyched about it. You know, it's just, it makes things tough when there's so few chances to watch it. I mean, you love Yao Ming, and he plays 41 games in Houston, and we sort of warm to, you know, whatever, to Ichiro and Santana. And, you know, I think we're past the point of the guy's got to be American, but...
Oh, I'm not. I need my Americans.
All right. Okay, I got...
I want to wave my flag as I'm watching my tournaments. I still remember Michael Chang limping around in the French Open, like being really excited about that back in the day. I need more moments like that. I don't know.
That's going to be rough for you.
Listen, I think people underestimate the whole Americans like to root for Americans thing. Look at July 4th, for God's sakes. You know, we have a big celebration every year about the time we told England to go screw off.
Yeah, exactly. The King George. It's funny because the Americans actually do pretty well at Wimbledon. You know, some good juniors and that kind of thing. But the days of Sampras, Agassi, Curry, you know, the days of three, four Americans in the top 10, how's this for a segue? That's like tape delayed broadcast.
That was my next thing. Yeah, I'm so upset. I was so upset last week. I couldn't believe the Murray match wasn't on. Like that, you know, whatever. I know they're tape delaying some of the earlier stuff, and they're afraid to mess up the fourth hour today and whatever other stuff. Access Hollywood was on at 11 o'clock every day here on NBC. But once you get to the semis and you have this match of Andy Roddick going against this Wimbledon's basically their first chance of having a homeboy, what was it, since 1920? Basically being able to win it. I just can't believe I wasn't able to watch that live in 2009.
Didn't Ellen DeGeneres, though, have that talking monkey?
Yes, and, you know, that did soften the blow. I'm not going to lie.
Wasn't Rachel Ray making cranberry sauce?
Yeah. I don't understand how you expect your sport to take off. Not your sport, just tennis.
Well, no, I mean, I think that's the problem. There's not a lot of loyalty to that. This isn't about building tennis or satisfying the tennis fans. It's just a ratings thing.
And it's, you know, I had the same criticism toward baseball. You have World Series games ending after midnight, and you're talking about a whole generation of kids who will not have that moment where they remember where they were when they watched such and such event. And I think the same thing, you could have made the case for the Murray Roddick match on Friday. It didn't turn out to be, you know, one of the greatest matches of all time, but it was certainly something that would have been really exciting. And I think even if you look at the Confederation Cup, USA Brazil, which a lot of people watched, did a surprisingly great rating on ESPN, did like a 2.7. And if that had been tape delayed, nobody would have watched it. So I just don't think that they have grasped that this is a big enough thing. In this day and age, tape delay sports do not work, period.
Yeah, you know, there are all these sort of pirated internet. If you're savvy enough, you can watch this thing live. It's just going to be the, you know, the Italian network on your computer. But I think it's only going to get easier to do that in the future. And I think I don't understand. I mean, there are three different networks from the United States at Wimbledon. NBC's got all these platforms, MSNBC, and you know they've got these digital platforms. It seems like nobody wins. I mean, Wimbledon looks silly because it's. Prestige goes down when it's not even live in the U.S. NBC's gotten all sorts of, you know, bad press and ill will from fans about this. And the tennis fans get under. I mean, it just seems like nobody's benefiting here.
I agree. And I don't know. What's wrong with watching tennis on the Friday before July 4th weekend?
I keep thinking of Jack Donaghy having to. Making it, you know, isn't there a good 30 Rock episode about this?
Yeah.
Lemon, I already know who won.
Yeah. I just, in this day and age, and we saw it with the Michael Jackson thing 2 weeks ago, you know within 5 seconds when stuff happens. If somebody dies, you're going to know. You're going to know right away. You're not going
to
find
Jackson?
Out. Well, when you're away, he died.
I was reading about Andy Murray's opinions on British penal code.
Well, and the problem is let's say the Andy Murray Roddick match was an all-time classic, somebody would have texted me it, and I would have found out.
Yeah, exactly.
So the fact that nobody texted me, that I would have known, you know, deep down I know, all right, well, maybe I don't have to watch this. But as it turned out, as you mentioned before, I watched it illegally online because they had some BBC feed on that.
Yeah, right.
That somebody played, and I was able to watch it on my laptop. But I hope they fix this. It's really not good.
It's not good.
It's not a good thing at all. Last question, back to the American thing. The Williams sisters. So I would have thought that the inroads that they made, and look at these two inner city kids, they've made it all the way to the top. Has there been a trickle-down effect yet from everything they've accomplished these past 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, it hasn't been huge. It's not like there's this flood of, you know, whether it's women or whether it's African-American women or African-American kids, period. I mean, it hasn't been hugely demonstrable. But I definitely think there is this class of kids that came up having watched the Williams, Madison Keys. There's some juniors that got started because of the Williams sisters. I think it's a little like Tiger, where it'll probably take a few more years, and it hasn't been dramatic. But I think it's coming, and I think... you know, it's interesting. I mean, they're really such unique figures.
Yeah.
And they've lived on both coasts, and they act, and they... I mean, I think most Americans almost see them as sort of phenomenons and not necessarily as tennis players, per se.
Yeah.
But I think it's coming.
All right. I'm going to keep my eye on it.
There you go.
Never know. You never know with this stuff. You never know when the next person's going to come. We kind of knew a Tiger, because even, like, dating back to when he was on the Mike Douglas show, and he was... what, 2-3 years old or whatever. He was always kind of on the radar screen. With tennis, sometimes it seems like it's almost like basketball, where somebody who's the top guy when he's 15 might not be the top guy 2 years later, and you just kind of never know.
Yeah, exactly.
Comes down to hunger, comes down to whether or not you married a swimsuit model at the wrong time in your career, got involved with the wrong person. Last question about U.S. Open. Anything we should know? We're 2 months away. Should I be excited about anything? Should I care?
These plots, they keep changing. Let's see what happens when Federer comes in as a dad. Let's see when this, you know, if you've done this drill, let's see when he's got Barney videos in his head and had to get up for that, had to play possum at 3 a.m. so his wife could do the feeding when he was asleep.
The Wiggles song going off in his head over and over again. Will Nadal be back or no?
I think he will. Let's hope so.
Do you have a UFC 100 prediction for me since you wrote a UFC book?
Picking Lesnar here.
All right.
You?
So now it's on the line. I was like, if they get to 100, fine, I'll pay-per-view one.
Look at them now.
But, yeah, I went to one, I think I wrote about it. It was at Foxwoods of the Mohegan or something in 2002, and some guy just got...
Oh, that's like...
Well, some guy got really beaten up, and it was bad, and it was like, we left, and we were like, oh, my God, And I it's about time for me to give another chance. It's been 7 years.
UFC in 2002 is like watching, you know, Christy Mathewson.
Right.
That was like generations ago.
Yeah. I'm going to embrace it. All right, John Wertheim, we can read you on Sports Illustrated and sportsillustrated.com. And your new book is out on Amazon and bookstores everywhere. It's called Strokes of Genius, correct?
You got it.
I'm doing this from memory. All right, thanks for coming on.
No, thanks. It was fun.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.